The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
It was a result that didn't surprise anyone. Vladimir Putin will stay Russia's president for at least another 6 years.
I'd like to thank all of Russia's citizens. We are all one team, all Russian citizens who came to vote. It's very important to say this is not a legal formality. The Russian people are the source of power in this country.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, surprise, surprise, right? Wow, cannot imagine Vladimir Putin won again. How did that happen? Well, people love him, right? 73% of the voter turnout over the weekend. Look, I use the term one very loosely. I also say that the people love him very loosely. Re-election for another six terms? He was never really in question. Right, Politico was reporting that Putin wasn't taking any chances, though, on the very first 2 days of voting. Thousands of public sector employees, students, workers from Russian operations, well, they were all compelled to cast their ballots. So turnout was monitored. It was monitored by management. There were civil service employees that were required to report back once they had voted. And in some regions, they were even expected to bring relatives and share their geolocations with supervisors via a specially designed app. Look, that's Russia, right? You see what happens in places like China. Here in our own country, this is a call for our own election integrity. We live in a great nation. I love America. You know, I love the fact that we all have a voice. I just hate to see some of the shenanigans that are going on, the manipulation of social media. Coming up in a little bit, James Hurston will join me. There's a big Supreme Court case that I want to just put on your radar that deals with government officials, high-ranking officials like the Biden administration, manipulating the information that you get to hear. Going to Facebook and to Twitter and to Instagram and a lot of these other social media platforms and having them turn the volume down or off on people who question vaccines or wearing masks or, you know, election, you know, Hunter Biden. I mean, things related to the election. That's not what America is about. And I really hope that the Supreme Court will be able to evaluate this. We're going to look at free speech. We're going to look at the public square. We're going to look at what has happened historically. I'll fill you in on a story you may not be totally up to speed on and what it means for the future. So Vladimir Putin, though, you can count on having him for another 6 years. There were protests, including efforts called Noon Against Putin, where people gathered at voting stations at noon Moscow time yesterday, including at Russian embassies across the world, to vote for anyone but Putin. But even with that, Vladimir Putin, he took in 87% of the votes. Supposedly almost 9 out of 10 people voted for him. Al Jazeera mentioned in this report, a lot of people are unhappy with Vladimir Putin, and they made their voices heard, knowing it was not going to stop him from winning. But here, I think, is a unique insight. Check this out.
The official result was never in doubt.
There were few ways Russians could demonstrate their discontent in this election and not get arrested for it. But at noon on Sunday, thousands did it silently. People came to cast their ballots at the same agreed time at tens of thousands of polling stations in 11 time zones and abroad.
It's clear that the president will be elected without us, but at least we will show ourselves. I came personally to show that I disagree and to show that there are many of us.
I guess I would like to expect change. I don't know if that will happen or not, but I believe my voice can make a difference.
This action was endorsed by late opposition leader Alexei Navalny shortly before he died in an Arctic penal colony.
Now, all of Vladimir Putin's opposition, they end up dead, right? They tend to disappear. So pray for Vladimir Putin's conversion. Pray for Xi Jinping. Pray for Joe Biden and Donald Trump. You know, the world is a less safe place when we have dictators. It really is. Power corrupts absolutely. It does. It's a poison when somebody holds on to it way too long. And given these results, given the fact that Putin has been routinely threatening to use nuclear weapons over the last couple months, you think that Europe, well, they'd want to tread very lightly when it comes to Russia, but the German chancellor, along with the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and the Polish prime minister, you know what they did on Friday? And gosh, we just see these events beginning to ratchet up, and it just gives me pause. They told the press that they want to use the windfall. You know, when they froze Vladimir Putin's assets, when they froze Russia's, they froze $300 billion in Russian assets when they crossed over and began this war with Ukraine. They want to use that very money that they froze now to purchase weapons to give to Ukraine. I don't know how that's going to shake out. That would leave, you know, the assets themselves untouched, but it would take away the interest that the money earns. And the U.S. and the U.K. want to confiscate that money completely, use it for Ukraine's rebuilding. That's been opposed by others as well. But meanwhile, Russia's neighbor, China, it's calling for members of the nuclear club. And I was delighted to hear this. They want those who have these nuclear weapons, Russia, U.S., other powers, that they said, look, we need to exercise restraint. Right. We need to de-escalate. The Today Show took a look at this, and they'll tell you a little bit more about Vladimir Putin, who has, as you know, right? This always gets me paused when a dictator, when somebody who manipulates elections, when somebody has unbridled power, threatens to use nuclear weapons. Check this out.
Russian President Vladimir Putin warned that Russia is ready to use nuclear weapons if there is any threat to Russia's existence or independence. Putin said it would be a significant escalation if the U.S. sent troops into Ukraine. However, he added that he believes President Biden understands the situation and he does not think the world is heading toward a nuclear conflict. Meanwhile, the Biden administration says that it is sending another $300 million worth of weapons to Ukraine. Biden has said the U.S. will not send troops to Ukraine.
So a spokesman for China's foreign ministry, they said that China believes that all nuclear weapon states need to embrace the idea of common security and uphold global strategic balance and stability, end of quote. That's the world's most populous nation, and they're calling for a non-first strike treaty between these nations. China's emerging as a world leader, right? But I'm behind them 1,000,000% on this. Although, you know, and I want to be careful about how I say that. I'm all about de-escalation. I'm all about treaties. I'm all about really disarmament. I think it would be great to have a world free from these types of weapons that could destroy humanity, destroy the planet. Even though China's saying, hey, look, you know, we need to brace the idea of common security and perhaps a non-first strike treaty, they are increasing their own warhead count from 500 to 1,000 within the next 6 years. So we're not going to have less nuclear weapons coming out of China. We're going to see probably double that amount. So we're at a weird time in the world. More nations are trying to get these weapons. Of course, we know of Iran and a lot of other places. So I think of the Fatima message and the secret, you know, that was given to the seers there. The third part of the secret was released, but there's another one that was always out in the open. And during the 20th century, you know, perhaps this was even, you know, more perilous. But one part that I've never seen fulfilled from that famous apparition 100 years ago, which was one of the greatest apparitions of the 20th century, the portion where the Virgin Mary says that there will be annihilation of nations. Right? She spoke of the annihilation of nations. And some people argue, well, borders change. Look at Yugoslavia. It's broken up now into Yugoslavia and Bosnia and Herzegovina and, you know, Serbia. And, well, yeah, but that hasn't been the annihilation of nations. You know, I do get worried when Vladimir Putin threatens to use weapons, when other nations begin to amp them up, and we've got a lot of enemies. So just pray for peace. I a little bit later, and I'm not going to get into it now, but I was just talking to my colleague here, Dennis, and to Maggie. You probably know that on April 8th, the day after Divine Mercy Sunday, also the day the church will celebrate the Feast of the Annunciation, there's going to be a celestial event that is going to unfold, and one that I just you know, it just gives me pause. There are going to be movements. You know, there's going to be solar eclipses. There's going to be events happening in the sky, and they're going to cross over cities, not just in our country, but in other nations throughout the world, with the name Nineveh, Jonah. And you know your Old Testament story of Nineveh. I'll fill you in. I'm not going to spend time on it right now, but it's really an interesting event. This comes right after Passion Week, after the Triduum, after Divine Mercy Sunday, at a time when the world is really, really rejecting God and embracing false gods, worshiping false gods, and offending the one true God, I think, in unparalleled ways. But that's a whole nother conversation for us. But putting that on your radar. You know, one other story here, too, that I want to get to you know, one of those things I think that brings down the justice of God is the sin of abortion. And I'm really saddened to see that Kellyanne Conway, she's a former President Trump's advisor. She was at a political health care summit that Republican candidates, she basically said at this summit that Republican candidates shouldn't say that Democrats support abortion up until birth. And I'm thinking, well, why not? She says, well, I'm pro-life. And she is, right? She's even Catholic. She says she thinks that Republicans should avoid saying that as a political strategy because most people believe that that's just too far-fetched, even though, of course, there are Democrats who do say that. And that strategy really differs markedly from Senator Marco Rubio and his advocates, which they're there to fight for the pro-family agenda, to highlight really the Democratic extremism on the issue, where you can destroy a child, you can murder a child up to birth. And, you know, Rubio and his group, they want to tell the truth about the horrors of abortion. I think we need to shine light on it, not downplay it. So Kellyanne Conway, she says, look, you need to change your strategy, you know, about Democrats' positions on this, because she thinks it is a losing message. I don't know whether you agree. Check out what she said.
And I think that if you have a party that is for sex selection abortion, abortion past the point of excruciating pain, abortion late term, and notice how I did not say and will not say and counsel clients against saying, oh, there are Democrats are for abortion up until the moment of birth. You know why that's not the best way to say it? Because nobody knows anybody who knows anybody who's ever heard of anybody about to give birth and says, you know what? I don't really like stretch marks. I'm not really ready to have another person in my life. I changed my mind. Nobody knows anybody like that. So when Donald Trump says to Hillary Clinton on October 19, 2016, you would rip that baby out of its mother's womb an hour before it's being delivered, that's sort of a metaphor for, well, who's really extreme here? And people reflexively said, ooh, could that be true? And I think it changed a lot of the conversation. But I think
so it sounds
the
like
way
this conversation
say,
in the campaign is going to be a conflict between each side accusing, highlighting the alleged extremism of the other side.
I think that's where we're already headed, but that's not where most of America is. And my entire point is, if most of America is not where the loudest, noisiest people are, you got to go to where America is. Politics 101, we don't tell Americans what's important to them and why. They tell us.
Yeah, but here's my take on all of that. And this is, to me, such an important issue when it comes to who you vote for. We need to speak truth about this, not water down, not try to hide it because we're afraid we're going to lose votes on this. I have a lot of respect for Kellyanne Conway. I think she's got some really bright insights. And she could be, just from a completely secular point of view, absolutely right on that. But I don't know. There's something about speaking truth to power, you know, highlighting when something is sinful and it's wrong. Light is a great disinfectant, and I think that's what we need. I want to share with you just something a little bit different. James Herson is going to be stopping by. Everybody knows that Donald Trump isn't the world's most careful speaker in the world, and that's why there are so many felony indictments against him right now because of what happened on January 6th in 2021, and over the weekend, Trump was talking about China building car factories across the U.S. border in Mexico, gave this big speech. I saw part of that. And the idea was to take advantage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which requires that the U.S. and Canada and Mexico charge no tariffs on any goods that are traded between the three countries. But Trump said that, look, if China does that, and he gets elected, because China's got a lot of car plants right now in Mexico, he's going to slap 100% tariff on those cars. Otherwise, if he doesn't get elected, there will be what he called a bloodbath. That's the term he used. Now, he's talking about the cars, right? The obvious context meant that the U.S. car makers are going to suffer. They're going to have a bloodbath because of all these cheap cars coming over the border. But wait till you hear what the mainstream media did. They went way out of their way to, I guess, reframe this and paint a different story about Trump's comments. The whole context of what he said was featured on Blaze Media. Let me share part of it with you.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it, went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
So you know what happened, right? There has been some real creative editing of what the president had to say. They portrayed his comments of a bloodbath as if though if he were to lose the election, there would be a bloodbath. That's not what he had to say at all. Not at all. Those same media outlets, along with social media, were coerced by the government to suppress free speech during COVID, and the Supreme Court heard those arguments today. Joining us to break it all down and take a look at what all this portends is James Herson. He's the author. He's a commentator, news analyst, law professor, a regular here on this show. You can read his writing. He writes a column for Newsmax.com called The Left Coast Report. He wrote a number of different books and teaches at Biola, Trinity Law School and Biola University in Southern California. It's good to have him back with us today. Hey, James, good afternoon. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good afternoon. Good to be with you.
So let's start first with the clever editing of President Trump's audio. What do you make of the administration coming out and reframing what he said out of context? And, you know, the liberal media is just so wrong. Instead of doing their due diligence, having an opportunity to actually exercise, you know, the gift of speaking truth, they take this thing hook, line, and sinker, and they camp out on it. Give me your take on what happened there, and did they get away with it? I mean, what kind of reaction are we seeing as a result of this?
Well, first of all, I think the shocking thing is that the media, and we're talking about the news media that is supposed to be presenting important factual information to the public, that not only was the news media coordinated with the same story, the news media was also coordinated with politicians, mm-hmm. such as Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton, who went on and said much of the same thing. And then, fortunately, there are segments of the media, like shows like yours and social media, that showed the whole context. Yeah. You played something that Blaze Media, that's Glenn Beck's organization, promoted. So, but when confronted with the fact that what they were saying was factually wrong, instead of retracting it, they doubled down on it, and in some cases melted down, like Joe Scarborough did this morning, horrible, cursing on the air. So these are shocking to people. But what it does, the media, what you call the liberal media, which is really the corporate media, is held in low esteem by the public, has very little credibility, and it's proving that it deserves very little credibility because this story is a hoax and it's being perpetuated and doubled down on. And that's very sad. It's tragic because, you know, we call the media the fourth estate. They're very important. And for them to be promoting a false narrative is very disconcerting for Americans. Well,
it stirs me the fact that the Biden campaign and the corporate media spread this clip, right? Editing out the context, no context, showing that, Trump was talking about car sales and depicting him, as calling for a violent revolution. He wasn't calling for a revolution at all. And then, I look at the other media that is out there. They're propaganda machines. And you know what? People sometimes only get their news from one source. They see this. And if that was my only source of information, I think, oh my gosh, this guy is insane. He's going to execute his generals. He's, all these things that they're saying about him. He wants violent revolution. It's tragic. I don't know how they can be held accountable. To me, it's really, really frustrating, but they're influencing the electorate as a result of this. How do we get balance? How do you get clarity? How do we get truth out there? Can they be held accountable? Can they be sued? I mean, you're also an attorney. I know you teach law. So, I mean, what kind of alternatives are there?
Well, right now they're being held accountable by the free market of information. And because places like X, formerly called Twitter, mm-hmm. has a semblance of freedom, and they've been able to counter this on that platform, lots of other platforms using the internet. In terms of the law, unfortunately, there's not a way, we have laws protecting invasion of privacy and defamation, mm-hmm. but our First Amendment allows media to have a pretty broad latitude.
I know.
But we used to have a thing. As a matter of fact, I taught a course in media ethics. There was a notion of what the vocation was of being a journalist. Yep. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people, they get paid a great deal of money and they work at various media outlets, and they have literally abandoned any notion of their vocation of bringing truth to power, bringing truth to the people, and instead act as, propaganda outlets, you used the word. And and when they falsely claim this is, in fact, the definition of election interference. It's interesting that it comes on the heels of a story that in the Biden administration, that Biden himself has been having what the media calls tantrums and been upset about his poll numbers and wants to change his strategy and get more aggressive in dealing with Donald Trump now that Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. Yep. Well, this may be, because it appears to be coordinated, the kind of thing that they've decided to do to build a hoax. But I do think that it is failing because there are enough outlets that are getting out the context, which is so important.
Well,
and the issues, by the way, the issue that Trump was talking about is a legitimate issue, because the mandate of electric cars, the mandate component, is causing a tremendous amount of economic upheaval in the auto industry, even to the point where, in today's news, the CEO of Hertz Rent-A-Car resigned over decisions that he made on this issue of acquiring electric cars. So it was a legitimate issue, but instead nobody's talking about
the
issue.
That's fascinating. James, I only have a moment or two left. I just want to hit on another issue, if we could, quickly. The Supreme Court is considering whether federal officials unlawfully pressured these tech companies to suppress posts regarding vaccines, the efficacy of masks. They did a number of other things when it came to the election as well. Your thoughts on what's happening? I heard one commentator earlier today say it's going to be one of the biggest free speech cases of our lifetime. What's happening here as this case goes before the Supreme Court and looks at the balance of free speech and the government's role in moderating and influencing content on digital platforms?
It is one of the biggest free speech cases. And we know from the Twitter files, those files that were released after a new owner took over Twitter, we learned about government involvement in the suppression of truth, in the suppression of voices, and which it's the government involvement that's key. And the key word that was talked about this morning at the Supreme Court was the word coercion. Did the government coerce social media platforms, for example, and other news media platforms, coerce them to censor out in the name of protecting the public from misinformation? Did they do that? And that's what the justices were discussing. And a number of justices, including conservative ones, expressed skepticism on whether there was sufficient evidence to show that coercion. That's the key. I didn't hear specific discussion about the Twitter files, but it seems to me that when the government refers to themselves as a partner with a media outlet, then that's more than just mere lobbying. And so we're not going to know the answer to what the court will hold until June.
Well,
but they're dealing with very, very serious questions and consequences. People lost their careers, their voices. They were muzzled and censored.
Well, hold the thought, James. I need to take a short break. We'll come back if you have another 5 or 10 minutes. We'll grab a few telephone calls. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149, taking a look at, some of the stuff the president allegedly had said, and also the influence now coming to the light of government coercion of the media. I'm sorry, Maggie, can you say that again? Did I say president? I'm sorry. Former President Donald Trump. Thank you, Maggie. Too many presidents, right? We will take your calls. We'll talk a little bit more right after this.
Your news, the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Got a lot going on in your world. Just trying to give you a look at it. Got to make our way through it together, better understanding the implications of a lot of this. A lot going on from the president being creatively edited, being portrayed as though he wants a bloodbath when he's specifically talking about, car manufacturers and unfair, practices. That's one issue. The other issue, then, this is a big story, and you're going to hear a lot more about it in the days ahead. There's a case before the Supreme Court that right now is touching on really the fundamental question about the balance between free speech and what the government's role is in moderating it. And the implications of this decision could redefine the landscape of digital communication. It could set precedent for how much influence the government can exert over information that flows through, a lot of these public squares, if you will, through social media. And it's come to light recently that, the government has been very creative in terms of, asking these companies to change their algorithms or dial back information when it comes to everything from people who opposed vaccines or talked about the efficacy of masks or the inefficacy of those or Hunter Biden's laptop or whatever it might be. So is the government overstepping its bounds? I'm joined today by James Herson. I hope you'll follow him at his website, jamesherson.com. He writes and tweets. You can follow him on X as well. His handle there is at the Jim Jams, and wrote a couple books, writes for Newsmax, and it's good to have him here with us. I always appreciate his perspective. Let's jump right in the phones. We'll grab a few phone calls for you, and we'll go to Eric first. He's in the Philly area. Eric, good afternoon. You're on the air with James Herson.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. It's kind of a subtle point to make, but I kind of challenge a little bit the idea that Trump is simply being taken out of context. I think that's true, but I think he has culpability that's a little bit subtler than that. I've tried to watch him closely, and it goes back even all the way to when Ben Carson was compared to a pedophile in Iowa back in 2016. I really believe he has an intentional technique where he'll say something that, if taken literally and precisely, lends itself to being distorted and taken out of order by the left, which he then can easily expose them to be non-credible by having taken it out of context or posting it, as fake news or whatever. and he can credibly undermine them in the process. But it also is stated in such a way that it really can incur the kind of negative behavior that he wants to produce in certain people while having sort of plausible deniability in the process. And I'm thinking, like I said, I first noticed this really back in 2016 when Carson tied him in the polls in Iowa in the caucus. And he kept referring back to Carson's book where he had talked about having a temper problem as a young man. And he repeatedly, Trump said, well, that's the kind of thing that doesn't go away. Once you have that character flaw, that doesn't go away no matter how hard you try. It's just like pedophilia. Wow. And he kept associating pedophilia with Carson. And, of course, technically he wasn't calling Carson a pedophile. Right. He was. But to me, it's unmistakable that he was trying to get people to make that sort of reflective identification. And I've seen him do this. I think it's a technique time and again. And I do think there's a moral culpability, even though it's correct to say that the left distorts it and abuses it in their own way. But I don't think that completely exonerates him, because I've just seen this done too many times to think that he's just sort of this innocent victim of misrepresentation.
Well, Eric, thanks for calling with that, because first time I've heard somebody say, hey, everybody questions his syntax and the way he says stuff. You're saying he's much more clever than some people give him credit for, that perhaps he makes these associations. James, your thoughts on that as well. I mean, I have a problem when the Biden administration or media in general will go in and they will edit out a particular statement, or they'll misrepresent something. But to Eric's point, which is a little bit broader than this last case where they did do some creative editing on what he said to make him seem like, you know, he was tyrannical. Eric's position, do you think Trump in some respects is as clever as a fox in the way he says stuff?
No, I think Eric is giving Trump a little too much credit for being clever. I think Trump was speaking in Ohio. His teleprompter wasn't working. He talked about his teleprompter not working, and he gets very, that's part of the reason people love him, is he speaks spontaneously and bluntly. And the use of this single word, bloodbath, each and every time there's a major move to the downward direction of the Dow Jones. Numerous media sources in the business world call it a bloodbath. Oh, there was a bloodbath on Wall Street. We've heard it a million times. So Eric did admit that the left distorted it, but somehow is trying to tie this into some sort of strategy that Trump has, that he used that term on purpose to sort of blow dog whistles or something like that. I appreciate Eric's approach, trying to be fair and calm. It didn't sound like some of the people on MSNBC. However, I think he's wrong. Absolutely wrong.
Maggie, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to say, this isn't just the media. This ad was posted from Joe Biden's X account. His social media accounts. And it's not even as much about what Trump is saying. It's about the images that are interlaced with what he's saying. I mean, after they show this clip of him saying it's going to be a bloodbath for the country, they start showing B-roll clips of men holding torches marching through the street. Wow. And obviously the conflict in Israel is huge right now. They show clips where people are saying, like, down with the Jews. And then there's images of Nazi propaganda, you know, like, so it, they're taking stuff that they're trying to connect him with. And it's vile, because he's talking about car manufacturing. So it's really insidious.
Yeah. Let me follow up with Dean. Eric, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. I think Dean may agree with you. Dean's in Stockton, California. Hi, Dean.
Hi, guys. You know, I agree with everything you guys have said. I'm a Republican. However, I did not vote for Trump in the primaries. And I think Eric is very accurate. Maybe Trump's not so premeditated, but he deliberately plays. He creates shock. I think he likes the notoriety of having created shock, including on January 6th, which played into the Democrat hands. So if he wants to win the elections and he wants our vote, he needs to stop attacking people of his own party, and he needs to start using his language more intelligently,
because he is giving the Democrats all the ammunition they need.
Thank you, Dean. James, I think it's a valid point. I think Trump is his worst enemy. You know, his mouth is sometimes with the things he says. But it's a double-edged sword because some people really love the stuff he says. And look, when he first ran in 2016, he came down and he's talking about, you know, all these migrants and needing to build a wall. I thought, this guy is so full of it. I when I heard all that, I thought, he's never going to get elected. He's just trying to build his personal brand. But the message ended up resonating. And some of the things he said were somewhat prescient. I mean, he was right about a number of different issues that we are facing. But if he could govern the way he talks a little bit, I don't know whether it would help him or whether or not that's his brand and people love him. How do you read it?
Well, I've heard this talk about Trump and how, you know, gee, if he was more careful with his rhetoric, he would be more popular. Except he's always been like that, going back to when he was, you know, just a media figure before he went into politics. This is his personality. And yet, he's ahead in the polls. He won Super Tuesday. He's the presumptive nominee. And this is dealing with the lawfare, dealing with the attacks on him constantly from the entire media and from the social media for all these years. So I have to disagree. I think Trump feels like he has to speak in a different manner to break through the noise and to break through the censorship. Because the fact is that the entire broadcast media, the entire cable media, and the print media are all against him, and he's dealing with this lawfare. He's currently in a position where he's going to potentially lose hundreds of millions of dollars by doing this campaign. So I think it's really kind of a weird, twisted thing to focus on his rhetoric when, in fact, the entire media, the Biden administration, and key leaders of the Democrat Party have all coordinated to basically perpetuate a falsehood and refuse to acknowledge it when confronted with the context. That's the issue.
James, we'll continue to follow it. We've got months ahead with the election. The other big story, and we'll follow up on this too, which is not going away, the Supreme Court's consideration of whether federal officials unlawfully pressure these tech companies to suppress posts or to turn things down. The digital era has really tested the boundaries of free speech. I know you and I will talk about that more in the not-too-distant future. But thanks for being here. Thanks for what you do, and I hope people will follow you at The Jim Jams. That is his Twitter, or now X handle, at The Jim Jams. Also, James Hirsen. That's HIRSEN.com. You can check him out online and all of his writings. Hey, Jim, thanks. We'll catch up soon.
All right. God bless you.
Thank you, brother. I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to touch on, if we could, just for a few minutes, the 32-hour work week. Good idea? Bad idea? How do you feel about it? We'll break it down. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
One of the benefits must be a lower work week, 32-hour work week. This is not a radical idea. France, the seventh largest economy in the world, has a 35-hour work week, and it's considering a 32-hour work week. But one of the issues that we have got to talk about is stress in this country. The fact that so many people are going to work exhausted, physically and mentally.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Working 9 to 5.
Little Dolly Parton there. That was Bernie Sanders you just heard with a proposal that I think some people think is great. Other people were saying, wait a minute, Bernie. Too progressive. The proposal of a 32-hour work week. Now it's gaining traction in various parts of the world. It's a potential solution to the improved work-life balance that a lot of people want. What are the pros? Well, they say you got a little more, you know, longer weekends. You can pursue your time with your family and your hobbies. You have better quality of life. Some studies actually suggest that reduced work hours lead to more focused and productive work from the employees. You're less likely to have burnout. And you'll probably be able as an employer to retain and attract more talent. What are the cons? Well, they're pretty obvious too, right? Employers need to hire additional staff to cover those reduced hours. Labor costs are probably going to increase. Wage concerns. There's a debate on whether employees should receive the same amount of pay for, you know, you work 40 hours, now you're going to work 32. Do you get the same pay? Employers may resist paying wages for reduced working hours. That makes sense. The transition is another issue. I mean, there are the impact on certain industries. It'll affect other industries, I think, more than others. It has been tried in some places, and I thought we could take a look at it today. Will we see a shift towards a 32-hour work week? How do you feel about it? I think the viewpoint from whether or not you're an employer or you are an employee will probably vary pretty dramatically. But I've invited Dr. Robert Kennedy, a professor in the Department of Catholic Studies in the College of Business at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, to join us today to take a look at this. Doctor, thank you for your patience and thank you for your time today. It's good to have you with me.
Well, my pleasure to be with you, Drew. Thanks for inviting me.
So I love your take on this. Looking at this from a Catholic perspective, back in medieval times, workers got quite a few days off during the year. They didn't get paid for those days off, but they had them off. Things changed. The Industrial Revolution has changed things. I mean, we've seen this evolution in work across the centuries. Are we now moving to a 32-hour work week? And what do you think are the pros and cons of that?
Well, you know, I doubt that that's going to happen anytime soon. As you know, we're in an election year, and all kinds of things are proposed in an election year. The proposal that Senator Sanders has made would require employers whose employees fall under the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act to be paid the same weekly wage for 32 hours a week that they had been paid for 40 hours a week of work. So it's a 25% pay increase right off the bat. It's really hard to see that anything like that is going to be implemented anytime soon.
What is your thought on the profitability of this, the benefit of it? There was a study done in Britain. They looked at 61 companies. They found that 24 of them significantly increased their profits. Their workers were a lot less stressed on the job. They had greater productivity. The other 23 companies had lower levels of increased profits. Does it depend on the industry? And I would just think if you pay somebody the same amount of money for less work, you need to somehow bridge that gap. And the costs are going to go up. I mean, but give me your thoughts on this. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing both sides of this equation, and you can make an argument, I think, for both.
Well, there's a lot of misleading information flowing around. First of all, I think you're absolutely right that if we think about the workforce in the United States as a whole, we're involved in a huge number of industries. So it's really almost impossible, well, just simply impossible to craft the solution for a problem for every industry in the country. The problems are different. The solutions have to be different. Areas of the country are going to be different. It's not clear to me just what problem a 32-hour work week is going to solve. Certainly, there are many industries where productivity simply can't go up because productivity is directly related to the amount of hours that someone works. Think about working a restaurant or things of that sort. There's not a lot you can do to increase productivity within a particular period of time. So it's not practical to think about doing this across the board.
My guest today, if you want to join us, Professor Robert Kennedy, and we're taking a look at the 32-hour work week. I don't know how you feel on this. You know, the other thing here too, Doctor, that I think it's going to change things. I'm not quite sure how yet. It's very interesting to see. I wish I had the 30,000 view on this one. AI, right? Automation, yeah. Technology. Yeah. It could really enable certain industries to cut back on staff, maybe give them that 32-hour work week. What role will technology and in particular artificial intelligence play maybe in leading us in this direction?
Well, of course, we're all wondering what artificial intelligence is going to do. But we've all also seen fairly limited technologies already changing the way in which we interact with the workplace. Think about what's happened with banking. Think about how many stores have self-checkout and so on and so on. We're seeing a lot of tasks shift to the consumer that were once done by employees.
That's true.
And technology will further enable this. So if we make employment too expensive, businesses are going to find a way around it. And we need to remember, forgive me, we need to remember that a great many businesses are small businesses that operate on narrow margins. It's one thing for Target or Walmart or a company like that to adjust. It's another thing for the mom-and-pop grocery stores and all sorts of other things that we do business with daily.
In fact, Don in Chicago is making a very similar point. Don, hi, you're on the air with Dr. Kennedy. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was just going to say a 32-hour work week would kill most small businesses. My family owned one as I grew up. There were weeks where the employees got paid and the owner didn't make enough.
Yeah.
And if you're telling the owners who operate on a shoestring budget that they have to hire more employees and pay certain ones 40 hours for only working 32, you basically just destroyed a lot of small businesses in this country. So that's hundreds of thousands of businesses you'd put out of business. Plus, they all employ a few people. So now you've got how many people out of work they were working before? And then they end up going on the government dole and getting unemployment, which increases the cost of that, which trickles down all over the place. It's a totally idiotic move. And even big businesses that would absorb it, like Target, the way they absorb it is they make less profit, so they pay less dividends to their stockholders, or they increase their prices, which causes inflation. This goes to show Bernie Sanders has no clue of economics or how it works.
Hey, Don, thank you very much. Doctor, I'll let you follow up.
Well, I think that's all of that is true. And again, it brings us back to this question of what problem are we really trying to solve? And what would be an adequate solution to that problem? It's just not clear to me. Now, I certainly think workers ought to be treated well. They ought to be paid fairly. They shouldn't be abused. They shouldn't be stressed out and so on. But let's find the right starting point to craft a solution.
Rudy's in Buena Park, California. Hi, Rudy. Go right ahead.
Hey, I've actually been on the union. I worked at Disney, so you know where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. I've been on the 410 plans. I've been on the overtime. And their negotiations, they reclassified full-time on the union contract between 30 to 40 hours. So it's all based on what state you live in. Mm-hmm. And the other part is the benefits. They don't talk nothing about benefits, where the cost. It's state by state, really, and should be up to the company.
Hey, Rudy, thank you very much. Doctor, I have 30 seconds to give you the final thoughts.
Well, I think all of that's true. We need to be thoughtful about this, and these kind of one-size-fits-all remedies are unlikely to be successful. Yeah.
Doctor, thank you for your time. Again, thanks for your patience. Always great to talk with you. I appreciate it. That's Dr. Robert Kennedy. We're about to pray the chaplet. I'll say a prayer for you, Doctor. Feel free to join me right now if you want to get in for the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. It's straight ahead. Don't go away.